engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
A wise man once said, "You don't choose the podcast chooses you." So consider yourself one of the chosen ones. Join us as we discuss books, masonry, esotericism, mysticism, lore, and more.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
In this episode, we begin discussing the lecture of the 28th degree, Night of the Sun. The night is dark, and the path is long. So join us, won't you, as we walk the way of the hermit.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Hello, Dave.
Hello, Gene. How are you today?
Good. You ready for part two?
Yes. But as always, before we get started, I want to remind everyone that show notes, chapter markers, and a transcript of this and all episodes are available on our website, wayofthehermit.com. As Gene just said, this episode is part two of a three-part series on the 28th degree, Night of the Sun.
And as we explained last time, the reason for having three episodes is that the 28th degree is over 200 pages in the annotated edition. So it makes up about one-fourth of morals and dogma.
Right, and we just want to do it justice. In a way, this one lecture is a distillation of the entire Scottish Rite system, at least to this point.
It really is. But of course, you can't just skip all the previous material and expect to understand this degree.
That's true of any of the degrees.
But especially this one.
That's true. So what's the first thing you have from the lecture?
The first thing I have is Pike's Christian interpretation of the Blue Lodge degrees. He starts off by saying, "Before we enter upon the final lesson of Masonic philosophy, we will delay a few moments to repeat to you the Christian interpretations of the Blue degrees."
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting. Do you want to go through that interpretation?
Not the whole thing. It's very detailed, but I do have a quote from the beginning that will give people an idea of what his interpretation is like.
Okay.
It says, "Man, after the fall, was left naked and defenseless and prone to evil. The human race staggered blindly onward into the thick darkness of unbelief, bound fast by the strong cable toe of the natural and sinful will. This condition of blindness, destitution, misery, and bondage is symbolized by the condition of the candidate when he is brought up for the first time to the door of the lodge."
And he says the death and resurrection of Hiram symbolizes the initiate being reborn into a brand new worldview and in possession of the Master's Word, which symbolizes the Savior himself, the Word that was in the beginning, that was with God and that was God, the Word of life that was made flesh and dwelt among us.
Pike really does give a great interpretation of the symbols of the first three degrees in Christian terms. And he ends by saying, "Such are the explanations of our Christian brethren, entitled, like those of all other Masons, to a respectful consideration."
So one thing it's saying there is to be tolerant of the beliefs of others, as always.
As always.
But because I know what's in this lecture, I think he may also be bracing people, too. Maybe especially Christian people for what's coming at the end of the lecture.
Oh, yeah.
There's a quote later on about the mysteries of Dionysus that says it contains symbols that, if irreverently contemplated, were sure to be misunderstood.
And this degree has some of those, too. So, what's the first thing you have from the lecture?
Well, the first part of the chapter is about the similarity of myth throughout the world.
Which we've covered before.
Right, and as we've said, Pike may be cherry-picking some of his examples, but if you look at the material he references, you can't deny that there are great similarities, not necessarily equivalences, because of the cultural differences.
It's Pike's version of some of Joseph Campbell's later research.
It really is, and as Joseph Campbell also noted, one of the key similarities between all cultures is that we share the earth and sky, and that is where most of the myths come from. Descriptions of celestial movements and the changes on earth that accompany those movements.
Pike says, "You have heretofore, in some of the degrees through which you have passed, heard much of the ancient worship of the sun the moon, and the other bright luminaries of heaven, and of the elements and powers of universal nature.
And the movements of the stars were symbolized by the heroes, gods, and goddesses of myth. The lecture says that you have been made to some extent familiar with their personifications as heroes, suffering or triumphant, or as personal gods or goddesses with human characteristics and passions, and with the multitude of legends and fables that do but allegorically represent their rising and settings, their courses, their conjunctions and oppositions, their domiciles and places of exaltation.
And the same holds true for the processes of nature. Pike goes through many, many myths and stories, which we've covered pretty completely in previous degrees. The stories of Osiris, Dionysus, Hercules, Mithras, Odin, Thor, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, and the Tao. But the main ideal Pike is trying to get across is that, again, in cultures all around the world, the processes of nature were personified.
Right. The gods and goddesses of nature were symbols of the alternation of light and darkness that plays out in the day and in the year, and of the corresponding changes that occur on Earth.
Again, we've covered this material in previous degrees, so it's mostly a review.
Mostly, but he prefaces that discussion by saying, "We ask now your attention to a still further development of these truths, after which we shall have added something to what we have already said in regard to the chief luminary of heaven."
The chief luminary of heaven is the sun. It was the sun's apparent death and rebirth that was enacted in their ancient mysteries. What's the new information that Pike is teasing there?
That to use the sun as a symbol for the all, it has to include darkness too, if it's to be a complete and whole symbol. Otherwise, it isn't a good symbol for unity.
In the last episode, there was a quote that said that we had fallen into error by splitting God in two and keeping only the light part.
Right. This degree is about finding a symbol that heals that split, a symbol that incorporates both light and darkness. Pike presents several such symbols, like the Chinese concept of the Tao, the Hindu god Shiva, when he's seen as creator, preserver, and destroyer. But the one I want to talk about is the Greek god Dionysus.
Okay. The lecture discusses how in Greek mythology, Apollo is usually thought of as representing light and Dionysus as darkness. Dionysus was usually depicted with horns and in the company of satyrs, or goat men, which makes you immediately think of our modern-day representation of the devil. So basically, Apollo ruled the light half of the year, and Dionysus the dark side.
But the lecture goes on to say that Dionysus and Apollo were the same, yet different, contrasted, yet only filling separate parts in the same drama. And the mystic and heroic personifications seem at some remote period to have proceeded from a common source. Their separation was one of form rather than of substance.
We think of those functions as separate, but they're part of one thing. They're two sides of a coin.
Right, but the real truth is the coin. The lecture says the mysteries taught the doctrine of divine unity, whose oneness is a seeming mystery but really a truism. That truth is Dionysus, the life of nature, who prepares in darkness the return of life and vegetation.
Dionysus and Osiris symbolized the vitality of the earth, and they were both represented by a phallic symbol, or as the union of the male and female, like in Buddhist depictions of deities united with their yoginis.
Right, and that quote I referred to earlier actually says that the symbols of the mysteries, if irreverently contemplated, were sure to be misunderstood.
Right. That's people with pornographic memories.
Yeah, but really, it's anyone who's not been prepared to understand what those symbols really mean.
I know. And it was the role of the Hierophants in the ancient mysteries to pass on through initiation the true interpretation of the sacred symbols. We talked about this in the 24th degree. The word Hierophant means to reveal the holy things.
And seers are those who have seen or had their eyes open to that revealed truth. Now seems like a good time to repeat what seers supposedly said at the end of their initiation into the Eleusinian mysteries. They said, "I have fasted, I have drunk the Kikion, I have taken from the box, and after working it, I have put it back in the open basket."
That's still as enigmatic as ever. But we probably have a better idea of what they saw. Likely something that might have been considered offensive to the uninitiated. But really, most myths, if taken literally, would be offensive or downright crazy. I mean, there's a part of the Dionysus myth when, as a child, he was torn apart, roasted, and eaten by the Titans. That sounds like what witches were accused of doing.
Yeah, it's horrible if you take it literally, but take, eat, this is my body as a symbol? It's communion.
Right. The lecture says that if we adhered to the literally historic sense, antiquity would be a mere inexplicable, hideous chaos, and all the sages deranged. And so it would be with Masonry and those who instituted it. But when these allegories are explained, they cease to be absurd fables and become lessons of wisdom for all humanity.
One other thing the lecture added this time in the story of Dionysus was Pallas Athena. He said that after the Titans tore Dionysus to pieces, Pallas restored the still palpitating heart to his father, who commanded Apollo to bury the dismembered remains upon Parnassus.
And De Hoyas had a footnote about that line. He quotes Clement of Alexandria as saying that Athena, having abstracted the heart of Dionysus, was called Pallas from the vibrating of the heart. Like, that's what gave her the name Pallas.
Maybe that's what makes her the palladium of the order. She preserved the sacred heart of the mysteries.
That sounds right to me. There's another quote about Dionysus that says, "All soul is part of the universal soul, whose totality is Dionysus. He died and descended into the shades, and his suffering was the great secret of the mysteries, as death is the grand mystery of existence."
And throughout the lecture, Pike refers to the truth preserved in the ancient mysteries as the primitive revelation or the primitive truth. He then goes on to explain how he believes this truth was forgotten. He says that what was originally revered as the symbol of a higher principle became gradually confounded or identified with the object itself and was worshipped, until this error led to a more degraded form of idolatry.
And it wasn't just misunderstandings either. The lecture says, "That haughty pride, which seems an inherent part of human nature, led them to represent fragmentary relics of the original truth as a possession peculiar to themselves, thus exaggerating their value and their own importance, or representing themselves as peculiar favorites of the deity who had chosen them as the favored people to whom to commit these truths."
That's really the rise of the priesthood as intermediaries instead of teachers and initiators.
It is. That quote continues by saying that to make these fragments as far as possible their private property, they reproduced them under peculiar forms, wrapped them up in symbols, concealed them in allegories, and invented fables to account for their own special possession of them, so that instead of preserving their primitive simplicity, they overlay them with poetical ornament and a fabulous aspect, until by close examination we can discover the truth which the parent fable contains.
And by forgetting the true meaning of the sacred symbols, the lecture says that they wandered ever deeper into darkness and were lost. And there was for them no longer any god, but only a great, dumb, soulless universe full of mere emblems and symbols.
That feeling of having fallen, or of being separate and cut off from God, we called the primal wound in the fifth degree. It's that deep feeling that something is wrong with us, or really wrong with the world.
I've got a clip from The Matrix that needs to go here, because it really is where we are in this degree. We're about to go down a rabbit hole.
Cool. Then I say, follow the white rabbit.
Okay. Here it is. It's long, but I promise it's relevant.
Okay.
"I imagine that right now you're feeling a bit like Alice, tumbling down the rabbit hole. You have the look of a man who accepts what he sees because he is expecting to wake up. Ironically, this is not far from the truth. Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know, you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Matrix.
Do you want to know what it is? The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us, even now in this very room. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth."
"What truth?"
"That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot You have to see it for yourself. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
So are you ready to go down the rabbit hole?
I'm a red pill kind of guy. What can I say?
All right. I need to tell a story, and it may seem like a diversion, but it's not. It links together ideas in the Matrix, the Kabbalah, and Gnosticism, and it's just a cool story. It's the story of Helen Keller.
Okay.
When Helen Keller was 19 months old, she contracted an illness that caused her brain to swell, and as a result, she lost her sight and hearing. She later described her early years as like living at sea in a dense fog, and she says, I was like that ship before my education began, only I was without compass or sounding line and had no way of knowing how near the harbor was. Light, give me light, was the wordless cry of my soul.
Ah, more light.
Exactly. But anyway, what I wanted to get to was what is referred to now as the Helen Keller moment, which she described in her autobiography as her soul's awakening. She says that she and her teacher, Annie Sullivan, were walking down the path to the well house, attracted to the fragrance of the honeysuckle with which it was covered. Someone was drawing water, and my teacher placed my hand under the spout. As the cool stream gushed over one hand, she spelled into the other the word water, first slowly, then rapidly. I stood still, my whole attention fixed upon the motions of her fingers. Suddenly, I felt a misty consciousness as of something forgotten, a thrill of returning thought. And somehow, the mystery of language was revealed to me. I knew then that water meant the wonderful cool something that was flowing over my hand. That living word awakened my soul, gave it light, hope, joy, set it free.
In the beginning was the word.
Yes, and she said that word startled my soul and it awoke, full of the spirit of morning, full of joyous, exultant song. Until that day, my mind had been like a darkened chamber, waiting for words to enter and light the lamp, which is thought.
So that's an actual account of light dawning in darkness.
It is, and here's one more quote from her autobiography, The Story of My Life. I left the well house, eager to learn. Everything had a name, and each name gave birth to a new thought. As we returned to the house, every object which I touched seemed to quiver with life. That was because I saw everything with the strange new sight that had come to me.
So, that's really a first-hand account of the birth of the Logos in a person. Actually, her experience of acquiring language. Another quote from the lecture that's relevant here says that, after endowing man with senses and a thinking mind, a portion, a spark of God himself penetrates man and becomes a living spirit within him.
And with that spark, Helen Keller created her own internal world, her microcosm. Whereas before that, she described her experiences like living in a timeless fog.
Which reminds me of what they call in the Kabbalah, Tohu and Bohu, which means darkness and chaos, before the light was born.
But here's the key question. What really happened when she woke up or became conscious in a human way?
She realized that the sign for water referred to the water that was flowing over her hand from the pump. But really, she understood for the first time what a symbol is.
That's right. It's like a light dawned or an eye opened that allowed her to use symbols generally, not just that one.
Language got kick-started, and with it, her whole world booted up because she became conscious of things in a human way for the first time. She started creating and living in an organized world of things with names.
Exactly. She started constructing her own microcosm, but everything that was made began with and was only possible because of that first realization.
And the word was with God. And the word was God, and without it was not anything made that was made. That makes it clear. The Logos is their ability to use and manipulate symbols.
That's clear to me too. But do you think it would be clear to someone who had not experienced that awakening themselves?
Ah, I see what you did there.
Yeah.
We've all experienced that Helen Keller moment of awakening, which is the incarnation of the Logos in us, We just don't remember it. Helen Keller only did because she was older when it happened.
Exactly. Here's another quote from the lecture. Incarnate intelligence, or the Word, is creation's soul as well as body, within which the divine word is written in those living letters which is the prerogative of the self-conscious spirit to interpret. God made man in his own likeness. That image is in the breast of every individual and of mankind in general. And every reflecting mind may discover it in its own interior.
That moment, when it happens, is like our own personal Big Bang or our point within the circle. It's our Axis Mundi. Everything gets organized around, or really by, that central point.
Yes. And, to quote Morpheus again, it's also the world that's been pulled over our eyes to blind us from the truth.
What truth?
Because we process the world through symbols? We live in a mental construct. It's not reality. It's a story about reality that we mistake for reality.
So we mistake our microcosm for the macrocosm.
Yes.
That explains what the Hindus meant by Maya, or illusion. The lecture says that the mind of finite beings is impressed by one uninterrupted series of illusions, which they consider as real. Of these illusions, the first and most essential is individuality. By its influence, the soul becomes ignorant of its own nature, origin, and destiny. It considers itself as a separate existence and no longer a spark of divinity, an infinitely small portion of one great whole.
But that's a consequence of language. Words and symbols, by their very nature, cut the world into pieces, which we can recombine in useful ways, as we've said.
Yeah. Solve et coagula. Dissolve and recombine. It's what we do as humans.
But there's one more question we should ask about the story of Helen Keller.
What's that?
That spark in her mind that, as we've said, went on to create her world, as it's done for us. Where did that spark come from? What caused it?
I guess another part of her mind, from another deeper part of her consciousness that was beyond language, which reminds me of the Taoist saying, the Tao that can be named is not the true Tao.
Exactly. The actual creator of human consciousness is outside of language. It's bigger than that because it actually creates that in people. Here's another quote. The framer of the fiery world is the mind of mind, who first sprang from mind, clothing fire with fire. Father begotten light, for he alone, having from the Father's power received the essence of intellect, is enabled to understand the mind of the Father.
So the Father in that quote is the consciousness beyond language that created the Logos, or the Son.
And you could say it's the only Son, S-O-N, because it becomes our Son, S-U-N, our light or organizing principle throughout our life, our reasoning power. But another truth here is that the Father and the Son are one.
And by that, I think you mean that they're both part of a perpetual process that goes on as long as they're human beings. The lecture says, the energy of mind is life, and God is that energy in its purity and perfection. He is therefore life itself, eternal and perfect. And this sums up all that is meant by the term God.
Right. God refers to the ultimate organizing principle, and that quote continues by saying that when we deeply contemplate or meditate on that concept, with all material interference being excluded, the distinction of subject and object vanishes in complete identification, and the divine thought is the thinking of thought.
Yeah, that's slippery, but it sounds like what's known as samadhi, which is a non-dualistic state of consciousness, where the subject becomes one with the object of observation, which would seem like a first step to seeing all of reality as a totality. First, seeing yourself that way.
Yes, and the lecture says that this was part of their doctrine, that one great and incomprehensible being has alone existed from all eternity. Everything we behold and we ourselves are portions of him. To imagine all nature with all its apparently independent parts as forming one consistent whole and as itself a unit required an amount of experience and a faculty of generalization not possessed by the rude, uncivilized mind, and is but a step below the idea of a universal soul.
That ties back to our discussion in the last episode about the Kabbalistic concept of Adam Kadmon. Adam Kadmon is the whole tree of life, and the 10 Sephiroth are his and her component parts.
Yeah, the lecture says the sages proudly wore the name of Kabbalist. The Kabbalah embodied a noble philosophy, pure, not mysterious, but symbolic. The Kabbalah is the key of the occult sciences, and the Gnostics were born of the Kabbalists.
And the lecture says that the Kabbalah taught the doctrine of the unity of God, the art of knowing and explaining the essence and operations of the Supreme Being, of spiritual powers and natural forces, and determining their action by symbolic figures, by the arrangement of the alphabet, the combinations of numbers, the inversion of letters and writing, and the concealed meanings which they claim discovered therein.
So what do you think about those practices?
That part of the quote that said, arrangement of the alphabet, I think refers to letter permutation. One practice was to permute the letters of a divine name, or a sacred word, or even the entire alphabet, and chant each combination. And they might do that for hours.
Those practices would definitely disrupt the normal way we process language.
Maybe to slip out of the matrix?
I think that's the purpose of those practices, to see the real world, you know?
Yeah. But anyway, the lecture says that by the Kabbalistic science of numbers, we could arrive at the discovery of the principle or first cause of things called the absolute or unity, that pivot round which it is compelled to group the aggregate of its ideas, the center of all systematic order, unknown in its essence, but manifest in its effects.
That's good, but I think I can give a simpler definition of Kabbalah.
Okay.
Esoteric counting.
Interesting. We've talked about one as unity, two as duality, etc., down to 10 as the manifest universe.
That's the downward current, how something becomes manifest.
So the upward current would be walking those ideals back from something concrete to things more abstract until finally the seed that it sprang from, its source.
Right. But let's talk about something concrete. Let's say you get an idea to make a piece of art. Let's say a podcast.
Just something at random.
Sure. But first, there's just a fuzzy idea. Or really, for me on this podcast, I just had a feeling of wanting to do something that I really cared about. That was the initial spark that came into my mind. And as it fell there, it picked up more tangible aspects, like the medium it would be, a podcast, the format it would take, you and me having a discussion, which equipment to use, how to make it available, until finally, we actually have a podcast.
Alan Moore says that is real magic. From a spark or a fragment of an ideal, something totally abstract, down to something you can hold in your hand, or in the case of our podcast, something you can listen to. But it's something physical and tangible that was literally created from nothing.
So manifestation is esoteric counting from 1 to 10.
Which requires you to understand the symbolism of numbers, as we've related throughout the degrees.
Yes.
And counting backwards from 10 to 1 would be taking something physical and distilling out its qualities back to the initial spark of the ideal that spawned it.
Right. Thoughts come into your mind, they fall, attached to more and more concrete attributes until, poof, they manifest.
And that makes a great analogy to the Gnostic myth of the fall of souls to earth as they become attached to material things. It's also Jacob's ladder, with the angels ascending and descending, thoughts becoming things, and then having thoughts about things.
That's the dual current. The Emerald Tablet of Hermes says it ascends from earth to heaven and descends again to earth and receives the force of things superior and inferior.
In regular terms, that's analysis and design. But here's the more poetic phrasing from the lecture. The dissolution of the world, they say, consists in the destruction of the visible forms and qualities of things. But the material essence remains, and from it new worlds are formed by the creative energy of God, and thus the universe is dissolved and renewed in endless succession.
One other thing about the Emerald Tablet, it's credited to Hermes, the creator of language and writing.
And you could see as Caduceus as the dual current, the two snakes with the rod between them being the fixing of that force on an object of thought. Which brings me to my last quote which says, "And yet, after all this transcendentalism, the very essence of thought consists in its mobility and power of transference from object to object. We can conceive of no thought without an object about which to think."
That seems like a good place to end our discussion of the first half of the lecture. We'll continue our discussion next time with other symbols of the dual current. So, what did you think about the lecture so far?
Wow, this one was intense.
It really was. What else do you want to say before we end this one?
Really, just one more thing.
What's that?
It's my definition of a true occult symbol.
Okay, what's your definition of a true occult symbol?
It's a symbol that refers to something that is hidden from yourself.
So how does that work? What's an example?
Well, like the eye in the triangle. People always say that's an occult symbol.
Is it?
It can be. We talked about Helen Keller and that awakening she had, and really that we've all had, but don't remember it. If I said that the eye in the triangle stands for that Helen Keller moment, then yeah, it's now a true occult symbol, because it refers to something that's hidden from us. You can't ever go back to before that moment. Something woke up or opened its eye, and that becomes you, or what you believe is you.
That's good. I like your definition.
So, what else do you have this time?
A couple of quotes. The first quote I have is about the relationship between religion and the mind. It says, "The history of religion is the history of the human mind, and the conception formed of it by deity is always in exact relation to its moral and intellectual attainments. The one is the index and the measure of the other."
That's nice. I like that.
The other quote I have talks about the dual current like the Emerald Tablet does. It uses the term superior to mean the abstract and the inferior to mean the more concrete or material.
Okay.
It says, "Such is the universal life of the world, reproduced in all beings, which its superior portion creates in its inferior portion. That is, as it were, the matrix of the world, or of the beings that the heavens engender in its bosom."
And you actually brought it all back around to the matrix.
I did.
Sweet. That's a good place to end.
I think so, too. So, Gene, what are we doing next time?
In the next episode, we complete our discussion of the 28th degree, night of the sun.
So, I'm David.
And I'm Gene.
Join us next time as we continue our exploration of Morals and Dogma, the annotated edition.
As we walk the way of the hermit.